I'm intrigued with like infinite depth of field. I want the stuff that's 500 yards away to be as clear to me as what's in my face. So that's one of the oddball things about the work is that there is no fading away.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. Elizabeth Bradford's nature paintings have a lot going on. She paints overlapping branches, thickets of weeds, ripples refracting sunlight. It wasn't always that way. For years, her paintings were smaller and quieter. But one day, listening to NPR, she heard a slam poet who brought her artistic life and her life as a woman into focus. Now she works with bold colors on big canvases, trying to capture everything at once. For those of you in the Charlotte area, Bradford has an exhibition called Warp, Weft, Water, Weeds at Davidson College from February 13th through April 9th. But you can also find her work online and in galleries throughout the South. And when she's not wandering the woods or a river somewhere, you can find Bradford at her family's old farm, an oasis for her and her work. Here's our conversation. What's the first piece of art that you remember making?
Wow, that's a great question. I remember being four and drawing the babysitter and telling the babysitter I wanted to be an artist. And that's, I think, the first thing I remember. Don't remember what it looked like, but I remember the experience.
And from that time forward, is that all you wanted to be?
Pretty much. It just felt like my identity from a very early age, like the thing that made me who I was.
And was your family on board with that?
Yes, pretty much. My mother was very artistic and a great art lover, very creative. And I think she thought it was great. My father was an econ major in college, and I think he questioned that choice, but he also supported it in his own way.
I read an interview with you where you felt like growing up that you were sort of caged a little bit because you had your yard was fenced in, basically. Is that right?
Not just that. I think that's a good metaphor for being a Southern girl in the 50s and 60s. And that's why that thread keeps popping up in the work, is because it is a metaphor for a different kind of caging. As a Southern girl in that time, you were supposed to behave a certain way, not supposed to speak out too much, always be friendly and upbeat, that kind of thing. And really not allowed to have anger or those kind of darker, scary emotions. And so I think being caged was more than just the fence. But I remember that fence when it was installed and how mad it made me. And I remember standing there looking through it at the real world outside of it and thinking that the part that was fenced in was particularly boring.
Now, you mentioned this idea of being kind of boxed in as a Southern girl in the 50s or 60s. Do you remember moments where you felt like that particularly chafed against what you wanted or what you were looking to do?
As a firstborn daughter, I was pretty outspoken in spite of all that, but I met with a lot of resistance from my mom, who was trying to get me to be a little more ladylike. I think the experience that chafed me the most was actually in my advanced age, when it hit me, the enormity of the cultural pressures to be a certain way, how enormous that was. I had just spent 3 weeks at an artist residency where I'd been working furiously and I'd produced a big body of work. I'd worked 50 and 60 hour weeks the whole time I was there, 7 days a week. And driving away from it, I was listening to NPR and a slam poet came on And she was young, you know, in her 20s or something. And she had written this poem about being a woman and how many times a day we say, I'm sorry. And also how it was not okay to raise your hand in class and speak out. And it just hit me how many times a day I say, I'm sorry. And that the poem talked about keeping yourself small, keeping yourself quiet. I came home to my diminutive but beautiful studio and decided that I was going to move everything in it to the barn, which is large. The little beautiful studio could only accommodate work just so big. And the barn space, the sky's the limit, or 20 feet's the limit. So I, in the pouring rain, moved everything from my studio into the barn that day and declared that I was no longer going to play small or quiet. And the work became big, and my career changed, my trajectory changed.
I have to say, I know that you paint on big canvases. Those particular things you've been talking about are not obvious to me, at least in your work, because you're painting nature and all these scenes. And obviously there's a lot going on there that I want to ask you about as we go along. But what do you see in your work, these nature scenes, that speak to these issues that you were just talking about?
One little thread is that none of the paintings ever include people or anything man-made. It's all just pure nature, with one exception. And the exception is sometimes fences creep into the work. I find them interesting as an artist because, like, if you're looking through a piece of fencing, like hog wire, it automatically imposes a grid on an image. And a grid is kind of a 20th century fascination, a modernist fascination, the grid. So it takes a completely realistic picture or scene and imposes this grid on it. And then I enjoy working inside the boxes of the grid. So there's a formal reason it's interesting to me. And I think that's sort of innocently how I stumbled into it, its formal interest. But later I discovered, I think there's a theme here. I think there's a common thread running through all these fences that appear. And then I think the compositions have gotten much more aggressive. There's a way you can lay out a picture. There's an architecture you can impose on a painting that it can be mild and boring and static, or it can be dynamic and nerve-wracking and a little scary. And so I think I have tried very much to trend towards the dynamic and scary.
Well, that's the thing I noticed, I guess, when I first looked at your painting, is that there are many things going on at the same time. And there are lots of layers, and it's not always clear where the focal point is, or if there is one, you know, that you're looking at three or four things that are all happening simultaneously. Now, is that deliberate, and does that speak to, I guess, the maybe depth of a person that you were talking about earlier?
That is so astute of you that you picked up on that. A lot of artists will choose one aspect of art and they'll lean into that, and all their work will revolve around that. Like if you think about Mondrian in his later work, there's two things going on. There's like a primary color scheme and there's geometry, right? And he's leaning into and fascinated by this geometric format he set up, and he's leaning heavily into a limited palette. And that's his thing. And if you look at Rothko, you've got color is the point, but also this sense of meditation. And the formal aspects of it are rectangles or squares. I decided that instead of leaning into one thing, I was going to lean into all of them at the same time. I wanted to talk about color, line, texture, pattern, value, space, everything all at the same time. I wanted to bring every aspect. I wanted to use every color. I wanted to exploit abstraction and realism, every single thing that I could pull into the mix to try to communicate what is to me the beauty of nature, which is its complexity. And, you know, we talk about, a lot of artists make art about information overload because we live in a time of information overload. So that's a common theme. But I say, if you want the original information overload, go out into nature and start digging and see how far that goes into infinity. The information goes into infinity. So that's the original information overload. And that's where I go.
So I want to go turn the clock back just a little bit, because I read that the thing that sort of triggered a lot of what you've done afterwards and maybe that your career as an artist was a trip you took to the Sahara. Was that in high school or college?
That was in college. That triggered my, it came on the heels of a fascination I'd always had with camping. For some crazy reason, camping out has always, since I was a little girl, been something I thought was just amazing and wonderful. And I didn't get a lot of opportunities to do that. There was no Girl Scout troop, and it just didn't happen. And then I got an opportunity to go camping, to camp my way across the Sahara Desert. It took like 6 weeks. We crossed the Sahara Desert and then came back through the Atlas Mountains. And it was 6 weeks. I slept in one bed the whole time. The rest was all on the earth. I came home, and the feeling I took away from that was, I think the big takeaway was that the whole world is my home. If I have a sleeping bag and a tent, I can be at home anywhere on the earth. And that was just kind of a mind-blowing idea. And then the camping also, I got back into it in my 60s after I retired from my job. And now I'm doing backpacking. And the backpacking really fed the work, because I'm going to these very pure, undisturbed places.
I know you do a lot of exploring as a way to kind of scout for your paintings. You take a lot of long walks, do some kayaking. As you do that, are you looking for something in particular, or just does something happen to catch your eye on these trips?
Very much something happens to me. I'm not looking for anything. I'm going out open-minded as a vessel, and it will be given to me usually. If I'm in the right place, I'm looking for something just a little bit offbeat that I can show you, as if to say, wow, have you ever noticed this? Or, wow, how crazy is this combination of lichen and limbs, or of whatever.
And it sounds like you have kind of an oasis now in the place where you live, which is the old family farm, right? What's the history of that place?
Oasis is a word we often use for it, because it's pretty much become surrounded by subdivisions and housing developments and businesses. So it's this weird little green spot on a map full of rooftops, if you look down from above. And it's linked to my brother's farm and to some other conserved land. So it is a tiny oasis. The displaced animals who've lost their habitat tend to congregate. The history of it is that my great-grandfather, Will Bradford, bought it in 1890, and he was 30 years old. He settled here and raised 5 sons and a daughter. And one of the sons was my grandpa. The other sons all went off and sought their futures elsewhere. Papa, my grandpa, went to state and studied agriculture, unlike the other brothers who went into business and things like that. And then Papa went and studied agriculture and came home, his dad lived with him. His mother was dead by then. So Papa lived here at the farm with great-grandfather and had all kinds of things going on. They had a cotton gin and a sawmill and a blacksmith shop and a general store and lots of enterprises. There was a time in the South when that was a real profitable, good thing to do. My great grandfather hit that time. He was here doing this when you could grow the cotton and gin the cotton and send it over to Belmont to be made into fabric and that kind of thing. Papa continued to farm after his dad died. And then he died. And my father would sort of gentleman farm on the weekends out here. He had a business in Charlotte, but his heart was always here. And then dad died young. And the house had been occupied by tenant farmers and by people who rented it just to keep somebody in it for decades. When I finally moved here right after college, my brother and I both moved into this house right out of school. And, you know, it had seven leaks in the roof and real rudimentary electrical, no central heat, that kind of thing. So long time struggle getting it to be livable and comfortable, but we did. And I'm still here.
And how many times a week do you get a call or a text from somebody wanting to buy your place?
That would be a day.
Yeah.
a bunch. Yeah. And that's recently become a real thing. That's really happening a lot. Now the pressure's intense. The expectation from the universal expectation is that I will sell and move. However, we shall see. Not likely. My intention is to stay here as long as I live.
When we come back, Elizabeth Bradford talks about how she has changed her working methods as she's gotten older.
I believe in adapting your circumstances so that you don't have to ever stop doing anything you want to do. You just change the way you do it.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Elizabeth Bradford. You mentioned your family's history with cotton and, you know, sending stuff to the textile mill. I know the title of your exhibition is Warp, Weft, Water, Weeds. And warp and weft are terms that I always think of in terms of weaving. Is that part of why you called it that?
Now, that's a great question with a complicated answer.
Good. Let's hear it.
Yeah. when I look out, like right now, I'm sitting here talking to you and I'm looking out at the woods behind the barn, and the limbs of the trees, it's just bare trees, but there's so many of them, and some of them are horizontal and some of them are vertical, and the net result is it's a solid patch of gray. You can't see through it to the other side. It becomes a fabric of limbs and trunks. And so when I'm painting these things with the overlapping limbs and weeds and things, they just, to me, I think of them as warp and weft. And funny enough, that barn I was telling you about that I moved into, when we cleaned it out to make it into a workable space, there was a spinning wheel in there, which just told me we are not too darn far removed from the day when women were weaving the fabric that everything was made out of, the literal fabric. And it's crazy to me how I knew people who were weaving that fabric. So really, it's very close. It's a very close thing. And the other thing is, women are associated, or I mean, women have traditionally and historically worked with fabric, sewing, knitting, whatever. And I learned to embroider long before I learned to paint, because it was a Southern tradition to learn those things. My grandmother taught me to make lace. She taught me to embroider. And it was just what you did. And I loved it. I made it pictorial. I would embroider pictures of my own designs. And then that was despised as craft. And to this day, you can buy a quilt with 1,000 hours of labor in it for $100. That's how valued that woman's work is.
Did you always paint nature type scenes? Is that what you did from the get-go as you were kind of starting out as somebody who took this seriously?
Pretty much. I have done portraiture and all kinds of things. Early on, I did, it is funny to me, and I do these things unconsciously. I don't know I'm doing them. But in my 20s and early 30s, I was really fascinated by flowers. So I did a lot of work about flowers. And it didn't feel like a good picture to me if it didn't start with flowers. And then later, in my 30s and 40s, I started painting fruit. Things in the garden, the vegetables, the squash, the raspberries. That was a fascination for me. And now, as an older person, I'm fascinated by these skeletal tree forms and those kind of things. So it's a kind of funny transition, subconscious transition.
Seems like there's a metaphor there for the leaves have fallen off the trees. It's
exactly.
And in the wintertime. I did want to ask you about that, and this is probably a good time. I think I'm a little younger than you, but not much. And I notice, you know, sometimes I'm not quite as sharp as I want to be as I'm getting ready to compose something or whatever. You have a job that a big part of it is physical. And I'm wondering if you've noticed any limitations or anything as you've done your work and whether you've changed anything as a result of that.
I just have to be more careful. I fell and broke my right hand, my worst nightmare, about a year and a half ago. I fell and broke my right hand, and it didn't heal right. It tore ligaments. So my right hand doesn't function the way it should, but I can still paint and it's still working. And I don't notice a difference in the actual quality of the marks I'm making. To me, they're fine. Sometimes my hand will freeze up after I've been holding a brush in one position for a long time. And the arthritis in my hands makes it so that it's really painful or becomes painful if I lift anything. So I believe in adapting your circumstances so that you don't have to ever stop doing anything you want to do. You just change the way you do it. So I have, I'm having ultralight stretchers made for my canvases. So even a gigantic canvas is not painful for me to lift.
Explain what that is. I'm not.
Ultralight. The stretcher is the wooden framework that the canvas is pulled over.
Okay.
Some people make them heavy and clunky, and I buy basswood, which is very light, and they're just like balsa airplanes. They're light. And so I do that. When I've been not well, I might have to paint sitting down instead of standing. Ideally, you want to engage your whole body. You want the energy of your entire body to show up on the canvas. But if you can't do that, you adapt, and sometimes you paint sitting down.
I wonder, you talked about these things you're drawn to with kind of all the layers and whatever's in the background is kind of obscured. Part of what I was trying to read into this or looking at it was, is there something behind all that that's we can't quite see? You know what I mean? Like, is there something on the other side of those branches that you're trying to get to, and there's just stuff in the way?
Now that is an interesting question. Let me say that I have a weird approach. I want the background, instead of, like, if you took a photograph, the background would fade away. Yes. Like, you would see what's in focus, and then everything else would be mildly blurry, right? I'm intrigued with like infinite depth of field. I want the stuff that's 500 yards away to be as clear to me as what's in my face. So that's one of the oddball things about the work, is that there is no fading away. There is no, oh, I'll just sort of put some blurry stuff back here to be the background. It's all textured and it's all happening. And then another thing I do is I paint this, like the so-called subject, say the thing that's the most obvious piece of the picture, say it's a tree. I'll paint the tree first, and then I will paint the world around the tree. Instead of painting in a sky and painting a tree on top of it, I will paint this bits of sky as they appear between the branches. Okay, so I'm elevating what's background, so-called background, to be as, have the same energy as what would be called the foreground. Does that make sense?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, so there's, it's a little bit different than the way the your eyes experience something.
Right, and the way most people would paint it.
That, you said something about depth of field that made me wonder, when you're out exploring, looking for things to paint, are you taking a camera with you, or do you ever take any of your painting gear? How do you capture something once you see it?
I do both. If I am, say, car camping, we call it car camping, when you drive your car to your campsite and you can take a giant cooler and, you know, all kinds of junk with you, like camp furniture and stuff. That's one thing. And I will definitely have paints and a small surface to paint on for that situation. If I'm ultralight backpacking, no. What I have to use is a little camera, and I sketch with the camera. And then I'm painting on these giant canvases, and I can't stand in the woods with a 6-foot canvas and capture it. I have to construct that in the studio based on data that I've gathered, either by sketching or by doing photography. And generally, because we are moving fast in the woods, it's photography.
Some of the places where you used to go for inspiration and to find things to paint, are they gone now?
A lot of them, sure. However, I do tend to go pretty far afield. That was my cure for watching the sort of degradation of nature around me, is to go way back into the woods where nobody goes.
I want to ask a couple of questions about sort of the practical life of an artist. First of all, I saw somewhere as I was reading something about you that you had painted something and you were having a hard time letting it go. Like somebody had wanted to buy it and you didn't, you know, part of you didn't want to sell it. You know, as a writer, that doesn't strike a chord with me because I'm trying to sell everything I write. Do you have that problem sometimes? Obviously, a painting is a one-of-a-kind object and there's never going to be another one exactly like it. Do you have some that you just won't sell?
Well, there are very few things that I've kept, and I've made hundreds and hundreds of pieces of art. 99% of them I have released. But once in a rare while, there will be a piece that is just resonates too deeply. And I also, right after I do a painting, there's always a honeymoon. And I'm so in love with that thing that I can't release it. And there has to come another painting into the studio that surpasses that one for me to easily release. It's funny, to be as old as I am and to have done as many paintings as I have done, what's crazy is that you do continue to grow and improve. I can look back on things I did 2 years ago and think, that's not the way I do that now. Yes, I love and respect that work, but I am in a different place now. And I can release that because I'm doing this. And I know the piece you're talking about. I hung on to it forever because it just created this crazy mood. And I had somehow managed to come up with a color in it that I have not been able to come up with again. And it was like this magic color. I was just having a hard time releasing that out into the world.
So you're about to have an exhibition, and which is sort of an odd thing, I think, to even among artists, you know, where you're there, your work's there, and people are wandering around looking at it while you're there. Do you try to eavesdrop on conversations people are having about your paintings, or do you stay as far away from that as possible?
That's kind of creepy. I have been in the museum anonymously when people were looking at the work and overheard comments, and they're usually positive. The thing is, you really don't want to attend to the negativity, because ultimately you are the artist, you are the judge and the jury, and the insurance salesman that's standing there not liking it, you don't need to listen to him. It's okay, because you know in your heart and soul whether it's a righteous object or not. So you just can't be too concerned with the complaints of others.
There's the art that the audience sees and the art that the artist sees. Sometimes those two match up right away. Other times it takes a while. I didn't see Elizabeth Bradford's nature paintings as a symbol of her emancipation of sorts as a woman until she explained it to me. But now I can't not see it. Her paintings contain multitudes, and so does she. Now, you don't have to know that to appreciate the work. It's colorful, multi-layered, a full sensory load. It makes it way more interesting, though, to think of those big canvases as the outward expression of a particular inner life. To watch, in a way, as Elizabeth Bradford blooms. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Eli Portillo and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.